Now we go to the Eightfold Path, and the first factor which we spend the most time on is Samadhi. Here he calls it right understanding, it could be called view, whichever one wishes to call it. And we start off with something from the Digha Nikaya, and then following on that we do a lot of what's in the Samadhi Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. But I'm going to say a few more things just to make it interesting for some of you. But first of all, Samadhi, a right view, is understanding the Four Noble Truths which form the heart of this Word of the Buddha book. So right view is to understand suffering, the origin of suffering, the extinction of suffering, and understand the path that leads to the extinction of suffering. This is called right view. In other words, understanding the truth of suffering, dukkha, and how it's overcome. Later on we'll see it's also understanding about oneself, and also understanding about impermanence, uncertainty. Usually we say those three things, which are dukkha, anatta. And here we start with dukkha. Now, very rarely do I talk about this, but it's good. The very first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, which is the first group of suttas, is called the Brahmajala Sutta. And it's pretty clear that this was the first teaching recited, because in the Vinaya, this is the mostly monastic rules. They also have a little bit of history of the origin of Buddhism, Buddha's enlightenment, what he did afterwards, but also they have the accounts of what's called the First and Second Council. And the First Council was once the Buddha passed away, after the cremation was finished, Mahakasapa decided to be a good idea for all the monks, or especially the group of the most well-known enlightened monks, would meet together to discuss the teachings. So it could like formalize them, so everyone would know what the Buddha taught, what the Buddha didn't teach. And that became the First Council, which was held in the Satapani cave at Rajaka, which some of you have been to, with the 500 arahats there. And there it was said that Ananda recited it, and the first thing he recited was the Brahmajala Sutta. So in the Vinaya said this was the first thing which was recited. And there's a good point to this, because this is all about wrong view. Because in order to understand what right view is, it's good to understand what wrong view is, first of all. So right view is the opposite of that. So here we have right view in its positive sense. But here I'm just going to very quickly just actually show what the teachings is not. In other words, there's 62 types of wrong view, the whole 62. Yeah. And if you want to have a look about them, they also say where these come from. But there is a sort of what's it called? Summary, if I can get it to the end. So, the 62 wrong views, it's the opposite of right views. 1 to 4. Monks or Brahmins who are eternalists proclaim the eternity of the self and the world in four ways. In other words, the self, the soul, is eternal, and also this world just goes on and on. That's wrong view number 1 to 4. Wrong views number 5 to 8. They are partly eternalists and partly non-eternalists. They proclaim the partial eternity and partial non-eternity of the self and the world in four ways. That's 1 to 8. And I can't help. I'll just say a couple of these because one is very important. Here actually they say about the beginning of the world. This is wrong view number 5. There comes a time, much sooner or later, after a long period, when this world comes back into being again, or when the world actually disappears. And at that time, most beings are reborn in the Abhasara, Brahma world. That's a sort of a second jhana realm. There they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, glorious. They stay like that for a long time. So that's very nice. It gives you an idea of what the jhanas are. Mind-made, feeding on delight. It's the delight, the happiness that keeps it going. But the time comes sooner or later after a long period when this world, the physical universe, begins to expand. In this expanding world, the empty place of Brahma appears. then one being, from exhaustion of his lifespan, or the merits, the karma, falls from the abyssal world and arises in the empty Brahma place. And there they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, moving through the air, glorious. He stays there that for a long time. Then in this being who's been alone for so long, there arises unrest, discontent and worry. You know what it's like when you meditate for a long time, afterwards you start thinking about something. And he thinks, oh, if only some other beings would come here. And other beings, from exhaustion of their lifespan, of their merits, they also fall from a basa world and arise in a Brahma world as companions for this being. And they dwell mind-made and stay like that for a long time. And then monks, that being who first arose there thinks, ah, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the conqueror, the unconquered, the all-seeing, the all-powerful, the Lord, the maker, creator, ruler, appointer and orderer, father of all that have been and shall be. These beings were created by me. How so? Because I first had this thought, oh, only if some other beings would come here, that was my wish. And then these beings came into this existence. And those beings who arose subsequently think, this friend is Brahma, great Brahma, the conqueror, the unconquered, the all-seeing, the all-powerful, the Lord, the maker, creator, ruler, point and order, father of all that have been and shall be. How so? We've seen that he was here first, and we came here afterwards. And there you go, is Buddha's explanation of the delusion of God. Which is actually quite interesting. But anyway, there, the first, was a wrong view. Okay, now. And this is, so they think the Brahma is stable, eternal, not subject to change, the same forever and ever. But the other ones, we were created by that Brahma, we are impermanent, unstable, shortly fated to fall away. We have come to this world. This is the first case whereby some ascetics and Brahmins are partly eternalists and partly non-eternalists. In other words, they think God is permanent, but they ain't. And that's actually quite an interesting one. Wrong view number six. Another way, they're partly eternalists, partly non-eternalists. The monk certain day was called corrupted by pleasure. They spend an excessive amount of time addicted to merriment, play, and enjoyment. So their mindfulness is dissipated, and by the dissipation of mindfulness, those beings fall from that state. It's interesting. And I think some of you might get reborn there. Like the playful Davis. And so having fallen from that world, they rise in this world, and they go into homelessness. And he thinks those devas who are not corrupted by pleasure, do not spend excessive amount of time addicted to merriment, their mind is not dissipated, so they do not fall from that state. So they must be permanent, stable, and eternal. But we are not. So there's another one. There are some devas called corrupted in mind. They spend a lot of time regarding each other with envy, just like some people do here. Oh, he sits so long, he's so still, that really sucks. Why can't I do that? And on account of their corrupted minds, they became weary in body and mind, they fall from that place. And the other ones who don't fall from that place, look at the ones who stay there and think, oh, they must be permanent, I'm not. It gives you an idea of how sometimes people think when they have those experiences, that, oh, there's some people, some devas, some gods are permanent, but others are not. But this is my favourite one. Wrong view number eight. And what is wrong view number eight? Here, a certain ascetic or Brahman is a logician, a reasoner. Hamming out by reason, following his own line of thought, he argues, whatever is called eye or ear or nose or tongue or body, that is impermanent, unstable, non-eternal, liable to change. But what is called citta or mana or vijnana, that is the self, that is permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change, the same forever and ever. This is the fourth case. So anyone who says a permanent mind in any form, that's called wrong view number eight. And also then we go to wrong views about the finitude or infinitude of the world. You've got the eel wrigglers who go to evasive statements. It's 13 to 16. I'll give you an argument. I'll give you one of them. That's right. There's an ascetic or Brahman who does not in truth know whether a thing is good or bad. He thinks, I don't really know whether this is good or whether it's bad. Not knowing which is right, I might declare this is good or that is bad, and that might be a lie, and that would be a distress to me. And if I were distressed, that would be a hindrance to me. Thus fearing to lie, abhorring to lie, he does not declare a thing to be good or bad, but when asked about this or that matter, he resorts to evasive statements and wriggles like an eel. I don't say this, I don't say that, I don't say it's otherwise, I don't say it's not, I don't not say it's not. So that's called eel wiggling. Or the number 16 is a fun one too. Another eel wiggler. A monk is dull and stupid. Because of his dullness and stupidity, when he's questioned, he resorts to evasive statements and wriggles like an eel. If you ask me whether there is another world, if I thought so, I would say there is another world, but I don't say so, and I don't say otherwise. And I don't say it is not, and I don't say not that it's not. Is there no other world? Is there both another world and no other world? Is there another world, nor no other world? Are there both spontaneously born beings? Are there not? Both? Neither? So if I thought so, I would say so. That's called an eel wiggler. So that's another type of wrong view. There's the eel wiggler. And then they've got who chance originalists, who proclaim the chance origin of the self and the world on two grounds. Here we go. So in other words, they think, listen, let's give an example of this. Number 17. There are monks, certain day was called the unconscious devas, that's the Asanyasata devas. As soon as perception arises in them, those devas fall from that realm. And it may happen that a being falls from that realm and arises in this realm. He recalls his last existence, but none before that. He thinks, the self and the world have arisen by chance. How so? Before this I did not exist. Now from not being, I've been brought to being. This is the first case. Because he's Asanyasata, so he doesn't remember anything before that. So suddenly he just exists. And there are monks and Brahmins, the next set of views are about conscious post-mortem survival on 16 different ways. They declare that the self after death is healthy and conscious and is material, immaterial, both material and immaterial, neither material nor not immaterial. Finite, infinite, or both, neither of uniform perception, varied perception, limited perception, unlimited perception, wholly happy, wholly miserable, both or neither. It's interesting, even people would actually perceive that the self after death is going to be totally miserable. Forever, this is. And they declare the self after death is healthy and material immaterial, is healthy and unconscious. So self after death is no consciousness. That's another possibility. Exactly, yes. And the next set of views is they declare the self after death is healthy and neither conscious nor unconscious. And the next one is neither conscious nor unconscious. So both conscious and unconscious, and then neither conscious nor unconscious. Okay, and the next view, 51... A certain ascetic of Brahman declares the whole of the view, since his self is material, composed of the four great elements, the product of mother and father, the breaking up of this body, it is annihilated and perishes and does not exist after death. This is the way in which his self is annihilated. That's a very important one to know. That's the annihilation view. In other words, this self is material, composed of the four great elements, in other words, identifying with the body. When the body dies, everything goes. Yeah. Another says to him, but this is 52, there is such a self as you say, I don't deny it, but that itself is not wholly annihilated. For there's another self, divine material belonging to the sense sphere, fed on real food. You don't know it or see it, but I do. It is this self that breaking of the body perishes. So even though another sort of self associated with the body, which perishes with the body. So these are all selves which perish with the body. This is the doctrine of annihilation, destruction, non-existence of beings. Okay. Yeah. And now we have the proclaimers of Nibbana here and now. And who proclaim Nibbana in this very life, an existing being, in five ways. Here a certain ascetic of Brahman declares and holds this view. And as far as this self, being furnished and endowed with the fivefold sense pleasure, indulges in them, then that is when the self realizes the highest Nibbana, here and now. So when you really sort of bliss out, sort of with sex or having nice music, having a delicious meal, you say, that's Nibbana, that's as good as it gets. So that's the sensualist. And another says, sir, there is such a self as you say, I don't deny it, but that is not where the self realizes the highest nirvana. Why so? Because, sir, sense desires are impermanent, painful and subject to change, and from their change and transformation there arises sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and distress. But when the self, detached from sense desires, detached from unwholesome states, enters the paths and vies in the first jhana, now that the self realizes nirvana here and now. That's wrong you, number 59, thinking first jhana is nirvana. And then it goes through the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, and the immaterial jhanas. And I see, this is the fourth jhana, it's as far as they go in this one.
So if you go higher, you can't.
Well, they don't actually say it in here. Wrong view number 62, the last in here. Because the mind, this is interesting, because the mind contains the idea of joy, this is in third jhana, and that state is considered gross, but when with the abandonment of pleasure and pain, the disappearance of previous joy and grief, one enters upon and abides in a state beyond pleasure and pain in the fourth jhana, which is purified by equanimity and mindfulness, that is where the self realizes the highest nirvana here and now. That is how self became the highest nirvana here and now for an existing being. So the fourth jhana. You could say the other ones as well, but those are sort of more refined states. And so I often make sure, I think it's a proper thing to say, is that the four immaterials are special cases of the fourth jhana. Yes.
Sometimes it says that what you said is in meditative practice and weren't really jhanas.
Yeah.
How is it that they are talking about fourth jhanas they didn't really know about?
Ah, no, they're not saying this here, but the Buddha is actually just, because of his knowledge of all the past lives, he's saying that these are the 62 wrong views, not just the ones which exist in this life, because, I mean, many people wouldn't have known what sort of Brahma was thinking. But he said this is just the whole gamut of wrong views. Just, that's why they call it the net. The Brahma Jhana is a net of, you know, total net of wrong views. They catch every wrong view in that net, like you catch fish in a net. It says, even the ones which aren't actually there right in the world right now, which can arise in the world later on. So these are the wrong views. So anyway, if you want to have a look at that, 62 wrong views, there's some very interesting ones in there. And also the Buddha doesn't just say these are wrong views, he gives some sort of cause why they came up in the world. Why some beings, because of limited experience, and it's all because of limited experience, they jump to a conclusion and they get a wrong view. It's fascinating, it's because the experience is not total yet, so they come to the wrong view. Yeah, first of all, I think? Yes. If we know that there's nothing left at all, total anatta, this is always the case that sometimes, as I mentioned in many talks, that the urge to exist, or the bhava dhanha, is so strong. We get some experiences and we think, ah, now that is the highest, that's the real me. So especially those people who have jhanas, say it's in the Hindu tradition. I remember talking to a man who had been practicing with one of the great modern Hindu teachers, and they were good meditators, and he was telling me, I asked what his practice was, and he said that in that particular tradition, Swami Muktananda, that to develop enough deep samadhi to get what he called a blue pearl nimitta, just like a nimitta, and then once you merge into that one, he said, that's samadhi and that's the end, that's merging with God. And that would be like taking first jhana to be nirvana here and now, the ultimate. And you can actually see what happens there. If you do get that state, if any of you have ever got that state, blissed out of your head, pure, at one with all things, loving the whole universe, however you explain it when you come out afterwards. It's very easy for someone who has come from a God tradition to say, wow, that was union with God. That was it. As I joke many times, anyone who has jhana here, who's experienced jhana even once, you know, if you were only a Catholic, you would be a saint by now. And they would be naming schools and hospitals after you. Unfortunately, as a Buddhist, it's just that's just first jhana. So you get much more bang for your jhanas in other religions than you do for Buddhism, in the material sense. But obviously they're just saying that that's how you can actually know, how you can think that that's the ultimate. And that is a danger, because you know, sometimes people do. They get into samadhi states and they think that's the ultimate. And it's, you've got to have that knowledge of Buddha to say, no, it's not, there's more than that. And that's one of the things, you say it's first jhana, you know there's 2, 3, 4 jhanas, there's immaterial states after that. The Buddha's great in teaching this. He says that that's the wrong view. First jhana is not the end. There's more to it. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Sometimes though, do you have to have the wrong view to be sort of still be doing this letter, isn't it?
Yeah, sort of. But nevertheless, some wrong view and some right view as well. So just even the right view as we come on soon. We go back down to earth in a few moments when we have like the 10 wholesome karmas. So I mean, you've got to hold on to those wholesome karmas at the beginning. Yes. Any subject cessation is great, yeah. That's anicca, that's nirodha. Dukkha, anatta. Yep. I don't know, he never said. But, you know, because, you know, right view begins all things. I think that was one of the reasons why, because he wanted to make sure to set out the position from the very beginning. What wrong view is? So what Buddhism isn't, first of all. So that's why it's a very important sutta. This is what Buddhism is not. And the next sutta, who knows the next sutta, which was taught in the Pali, yes, right, the fruits of the holy life, which is a far more positive, that's a sutta, about how to attain enlightenment. That's the first time we have the gradual path. And so that's another very beautiful sutta in the Digha. That's number 2. So first of all, it's saying that, you know, what's wrong with you? Get that out of the way. And now what do you do next to actually attain the right view? Yeah, they have that part of it. This is, they call like the moralities. And this is not just for monks, it's for everybody. It's just, you know, what you should not be doing. Computer, oh no, that means, no, that's not really wrong livelihood. It's actually if you sort of fraudulent computing. So you can still be an accountant. Books, yeah. Cool. So now we go back to Earth. And we get, this is from the Sammatthi Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, about understanding the wholesome and the unwholesome, the kusala and anakusala. And to me, that's the usual word, the wholesome and unwholesome. And I don't know, from a sort of a Christian upbringing, that was sort of, you know, rebelled against that. Having a wholesome lifestyle meant really boring and sort of straight jacket and square. And to this day, I sort of rebel against the word wholesome. I prefer like skillful and unskillful, which I think is a much better translation of that term. Skillful and unskillful. And skillful means it actually is going to complete the task which you aim for. So, you know, if you're skillful sweeping, you know, you get the job done with little effort and you have to make a good job of it. So you're very skillful the way you sweep, or you're skillful the way you cook. You're skillful the way, you know, you can drive a car. So it's more like skillful rather than this idea of like wholesome and unwholesome. And of course it's skillful because it's going to lead to peace, happiness and eventually nirvana.
But there's a thing about him, he's a kusala driver.
I think they did. He was a skillful chariot maker.
Oh,
a chariot maker. That's right, yeah. Yeah, the one who was actually good at making chariots. A builder of chariots. Skillful in that. So again, When a noble disciple understands what is karmically skillful and the root of skillful karma, what is karmically unskillful and the root of unskillful karma, then he has right understanding. So you get an understanding of the law of karma, which is important. Okay, that's worldly in a sense, it's just going to get you some good rebirths, but it's still important. So, what is karmically unskillful? In other words, going to sort of lead you into trouble. Destruction of living beings is karmically unskillful. Stealing is karmically unskillful. Unlawful sexual intercourse is karmically unskillful. Lying is karmically unskillful. Tale bearing, that's malicious tale bearing, is karmically unskillful. And what that's explained as is that you hear somebody say something and you repeat that just to cause dissension, you know, in sort of the community. And I must admit, during that bhikkhuni stuff which was going on, there was a lot of malicious sort of tale-bearing going along. And that was actually really bad speech there. So it has to be malice there. In other words, you want to create more problems. If you're doing that to create harmony, and you sort of tell us, oh, that's not what Ajahn Brahm really said, or that's not what Ajahn Jnana Dhamma really meant, then if you actually repeat the tales to cause harmony, that is right speech. And they make it very clear in this particular type of what's skillful speech, is that it's really whether you are malicious, want to create rifts between people and disharmony. That particular type of malice, that's what is wrong speech. But if you bear a tale because you really want to help somebody, then that is not wrong speech. So tale bearing is okay if it's done with a good heart. In other words, you know, you may sort of see somebody, you know, in the next room, and just, you know, they are, I don't know, doing something absolutely stupid. You know, they're sort of beating themselves or something because they don't like sort of, you know, the meditation. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And he come and tell me, he said, look, you better stop that guy, they're going crazy. Then that's actually helpful tale bearing. So if you see anyone really doing, I think, really, really stupid, then sort of, you know, not sleeping or just killing themselves or whatever, then please tell that tale. It's not malicious, it's for the sake of harmony, it's for a good reason. But if you come up and say, you know, have you seen this particular monk, you know, he's got this TV in his room, he's messing around, he's reading copies of Playboy magazine under his bed or whatever. And, you know, that's good to tell me, because then I can just take him aside and say, look, you know, that's just going a bit too far. Intention, yeah. And what you really want to achieve by this, you're really trying to help this person. You're not trying to sort of get him into trouble. So get kicked out. Yeah. Could be both ways. So you've got to see, what am I doing? Yeah.
So when does that
stand in? It's the tale bearing. So when I say, oh, I hear what Polian said in the interviews, I heard what she said about Analia. Analia, do you know what she said about you? And if I'm doing that just, you know, to create problems between the two of you, that's the malice there. So, you know, if you sort of, in order because you want sort of the rift to last longer, then you say, do you hear what Ajahn Jnana Dhamma was really saying about you, Ajahn Brahm? And, you know, if you say things like that, that's out of malice. If it's, you know, you think, well, you know, there's a problem here, you should sort of address it, then that's for good intention. So if you're going to bear a tale, make sure it's, you know, there's a good intention behind it. Not just for gossiping, just to create dissension and disharmony. Yes? Yeah. That's part of it, because it's like, you know, to get influence with other people, sometimes you like to sort of put other people down. And it sort of, you know, it means that you are higher You may feel pretty bad about yourself, your meditation's not going very well, but then if you put everyone else down in the monastery, you feel quite good. At least I'm meditating. And those other people, they say they're meditating. I've looked in their rooms, they're just sleeping, Ajahn Brahm. They sleep all day. And you do that sometimes. It's malice because it's just putting them down to make you feel better. That's under malicious. Tailbearing. The harsh language is coming next. Now it's more like when we control other people. You stupid girl! Now straight away, that's malice. In the tone of voice and calling somebody stupid, which is harsh. That's why if you are criticizing anybody, and this is from the Ranavibhanga Sutta, please keep this in mind. You never criticize a person. You never call, that's a stupid thing you did, like Peng. That's what you say. You don't say you're a stupid girl. So this is actually, you don't criticize a person, you criticize their act. So if no one is stupid, no one is crazy, no one's an idiot, but we all do idiotic things from time to time. Sometimes that's when we use that sort of really sort of harsh speech instead of loud speech and shout at people. And sometimes we do use that criticism to get people to do things by dominating them. It's just really stupid. You're an idiot. Come on. You know, do better. So a lot of time we put people down, criticize them to have power over them, dominate them first, put them down, and then they're more malleable. Or shout, and so we use fear. And that's with a loud voice, or criticizing people in public. That creates a sense of fear, which means we can dominate them. That's all harsh speech. And the opposite of that harsh speech is speech which is courteous, which is pleasant to the ear, agreeable, and loved by people. And that's the opposite. And that's a beautiful speech. You know, when people don't shout at you, they say, "Now, Lai Ping, come on, now you can do better. Come on, I know you. For such a long time, a really great person, wonderful person. Come on, now you can do that." And that type of encouraging speech is very, very nice. And when you get that type of encouraging speech, you really want to sort of help and work harder. So if you are going to encourage each other, you know, encourage each other with kind speech and don't slag each other off. You find you get much better results, you know, when you need some help in the kitchen. Say, washing up. You don't say, "Oh, come on, Nicholas, you know, I know you're on retreat, but come and give us a hand, you stupid Anagarika. You know, you should take more responsibility. You're head Anagarika, after all." They don't say that. You subscribe and say, "No, Nicholas, I know sort of, you know, it's your retreat time and how hard you work, but, you know, would you mind? You know, just only half an hour, and I'll help you, you know, when later on when you're on duty." And people are kind of that. You want to help. This is old stories. I can't tell this very often. This guy told me he was running a fete for a school, a fundraiser. And so they had many, many stalls, and one of the things they had was camel rides around the park. So, you know, they can get the camels around Perth somewhere or other. And you get a camel, and people who've never been on a camel before, they get on the top there, pay $1 or something, go around the park, and just never ridden on a camel before. So this guy with the camel had been raising a lot of money for the school, and he got to the end of the day, like a really hot day, and he was packing up, made quite a bit of money, and this guy came really late, said, "Oh, can I have a go on the camel?" He said, "No, we finished off now." He said, "Oh, I've always wanted to ride a camel, you know, can I?" And it's, you know, for sort of charity. And so sort of the guy said, "Okay, I'm sure enough, because it's another dollar for the school, sure." So the guy said, "Okay, camel, get down." The camel would not get down. This was the guy who wanted to ride it. He said, "Look, the camel won't get down." He said, "Look, that's not the way to do it." And the owner just stroked the camel. And the people saw this, they said, stroked the camel and said, "Look, camel, you've done such a lot of good work today. You've raised so much money for this school, you know, but the kids still need some more. And this guy, and he's just come from a long distance and he always wanted to ride a camel. Just one more time, would you mind?" And he's talked like this to a camel. And the camel went straight down and let this guy go on the back, even though the camel was just so tired. he said it was amazing that, you know, you could see that an animal is not supposed to understand human speech. Can certainly understand whether it's harsh or whether it's soft. It's far more amenable to actually to kind speech. And there's a beautiful example on just, you know, how to get people to help you. Do people like camels? If you wanted to help you, just stroke them. Now there, you know, nice sort of fellow sort of Allegarica. You know, I really sort of feel a bit tired and I don't really, can't do all this driving today. Could you help me? Whoa, okay. It does actually work. So anyway, how do you get on to that? Oh, that's right. That's harsh speech. Harsh language. Yes? Scaring those crows, making them psychotic. That's right, yeah. It's a good example. I remember sort of being disturbed when I was in this monastery in Thailand by a mouse who would always... The mice, they sleep during the day, you know, when I'm sort of meditating. But sometimes at night time, when you're just about to go to sleep, you're meditating all day, you're tired. As soon as you lay down and go to sleep, they start playing around in the roof, making all the noise, keep you awake. So I managed to catch this mouse. And of course, you know, I let it go. And as I let it go, I remember wishing it, may you be happy and well, somewhere else, but not in my heart, please. So you can send it away with loving kindness. You know, may you be well and happy, may you be free, but not in my heart, please. So when you actually move that spider, move it to a nice place. You know, so don't sort of deliberately sort of put it in a place where, you know, it's going to be sort of hurt. And, you know, with kindness, and just wish it well. So yeah, we, you know, we have to look after our hearts, so we have to sweep the cobwebs, even though it means that the poor spider has to run away. But you do it sort of carefully, so the spider says, you know, doesn't get too paranoid. Okay. Frivolous talk. I usually call that gossip here, but it's not really gossip. Frivolous talk is much better. It means talk which has got no real purpose. Talk just for talk's sake. So if you want to have a good example of what frivolous talk is, next, after the Rage Retreat, go into the coffee club. You know what frivolous talk is. Although that sometimes, now I was saying that, but I think it's an exaggeration, because sometimes that it's good just to have a bit of sort of lightheartedness where you can just tell our jokes to each other, because that actually lightens people's up. It's got a purpose to it. Otherwise people get too tense and too stuffed up. And that's why I allow that. I remember I allowed that once when I went to go to one of the strictest monasteries in Thailand, Ajahn Mahabua's. And it was great at that particular time. I can go visit different monasteries to see how they do things and why they do things. And these weren't stupid monks. When it got to their afternoon tea time, Ajahn Mahabua would come along and he would say, we wouldn't talk Dhamma talk, he would talk frivolous speech. I was really sort of quite surprised at this. I thought, you know, this guy is supposed to be Dhamma. Isn't he always supposed to teach Dhamma? He's just talking about this, that and the other, telling old stories, laughing. And I realised that, you know, there is a time for relaxation. And when you have that time for relaxation, just like Anagarika's sitting around in the morning with a cup of tea at breakfast time, talking about all sorts of rubbish, sometimes interesting stuff, but sometimes stupid stuff, it just gives you that sense of community, that sense of friendship. As long as you don't do it too much. So a little bit of frivolous speech, it's not really frivolous because it's got a purpose behind it. Just to lighten up. If it goes on too much, it becomes frivolous. Now the last three over here is, it takes the idea of karma to a totally different level. The first word is covetousness, it's the same word as loke abhijja again. Which means actually the first hindrance, I mean sensory desire, not just covetousness. is karmically unskillful, ill will is karmically unskillful, and wrong views are karmically unskillful. And gee, in other words, the only way to do something karmically skillful is to have right view and be a stream winner, have no sort of desire and ill will and be an anagami. So that actually puts the level up a huge amount. So these ten are called the, I don't like the evil, the unskillful courses of action. Now what are the roots of this? Again, greed, hatred and delusion. Basically the last three. They're the roots of unskillful action. Therefore I say these demeritorious actions are of three kinds, either due to greed, due to hatred, or due to stupidity or delusion, which is true. Now can you have, it's interesting here, can you have due to greed without delusion? Due to delusion without greed? What combinations of those three can you have or not have? Yeah, you're not supposed to go too far. You're reading the answers. Okay. Now, karmically unwholesome is considered unskillful is considered every volitional act of body, speech, or mind which is rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. It is regarded as unskillful, unwholesome, unskillful, as it produces evil and painful results in this or some future existence. The state of will or volition is really that which counts as action. Karma is chaitanya. It may manifest itself as action of the body or speech. If it does not manifest itself outwardly, it's counted as mental action. This is the one. The state of greed and hatred is always accompanied by delusion, the latter being the primary root of all evil. So it's not money is the root of all evil. It's delusion is the root of all evil. Greed and hatred, however, cannot coexist in one and the same moment of consciousness. Can it? Can give an example of lust and anger at the same time? I love you, darling. Bang. No, it's one or the other. You kind of both. One can follow after the other in quick succession. What about if you don't have any action of body or speech, but you just think these cruel thoughts towards, you know, the person in your next room? You think, this may drop dead. He makes so much noise in the room next to me. Is that bad karma? You haven't done anything. But doesn't karma mean action? Okay, very good. You're right, I'm just testing you out. It is still bad karma, even just thinking bad things. But what's the difference then between just thinking? You know, because many people think all sorts of bad things. They may think, oh, may you drop dead, may you fall into a pit of snakes, or that curse the other day which I said, may your armpits be infested with the, with the fleas of 1,000 camels. That's a very famous Arabic curse. May your armpits be infected by the fleas of 1,000 camels. Which is quite imaginative. So thinking of that, is that the same as sort of hitting somebody?
Well, the karma is not completed, but it still kind of leaves a trace and an inclination.
It seems if you actually follow through, the delusion gets stronger because you believe in reality, but actually in reality.
Yeah, so it's still bad karma, it's much less than if you actually did something or said something. So it's more stuff. But still, you've got to be careful because it can create a bit of a problem. Now, of those 10 sort of unskillful karmas, have you noticed anything missing there? Yeah. Nothing about alcohol. You've got the first precept, the second precept, the third precept, the fourth precept. There's nothing there about drinking alcohol. So, drinking alcohol, having a beer, is not an unskillful action. Is it? That's what it says here. Any comments? Well, what's he Christmas here? He does not as well.
Maybe it's an integral part of a lot of medieval action, or the unconscious action. It's like a foundation for the rock.
Yeah.
The action itself is not fairly important.
It's a yes, go on. Well, why isn't it put in here then? I think the reason is you can always include that in number 8, so the sensory desire. Could you do that for sensual fun and pleasure? Well, it comes from sensory desire. These are, they call it mental actions, but that's actually wrong. It's anything which comes from covetousness, from sensory desire.
This,
yeah. Sensory desire, yeah. Anyway, that's why I put it in anyway. Yes. Ah, that's the roots of unwholesome karma. Those are the three kalesas. Greed, hate and delusion. Through the kalesas, yes. Now, we have the opposite. What is the karmically skillful? And it says here, to abstain from killing living beings, to abstain from stealing, to abstain from unlawful sexual intercourse, to abstain from lying, to abstain from tale-bearing, to abstain from harsh language, to abstain from frivolous talk, to abstain from covetousness, ill will, and right understanding is karmically wholesome. So does that mean that someone in a coma always does karmically wholesome action? Can't be skillful. Don't have any Chaitanya. What about somebody who has had a lobotomy and who is mentally unstable because they don't kill, they don't steal, they don't have an awful sexual intercourse? So is just doing nothing unskillful? Now, I think one of the problems is, the answer is actually, that when it says in Pali to abstain from killing it, this is actually a little bit of a bad translation. It doesn't mean just not doing it, it means actually doing the opposite. So the word actually abstaining from killing in Pali carries the meaning that you are looking after living beings, you're caring for them. So in other words, if you see the snail on the path, you don't say, well, as long as I don't step on it, I'm doing something wholesome. No, you take it off the path. So it's not just not harming beings, it's actually caring for them.
Not making lobotomy to anybody.
That's right, not making lobotomy, not hitting anybody, not sort of being cruel to anybody, but certainly not ending people's lives. So it's actually caring for them, it's the opposite. The same from stealing. This is, I think, Buddhadasa mentioned this. So it doesn't mean just not taking, it means also giving. The opposite of stealing, being generous.
Translation. The reason that in the Pali they use that is that it makes the parameter for the action.
Indeed. Yeah. So that's a very good way of looking at it. Yeah?
It seems that a lot of the pleasure in the skillful way is to do with giving benefits.
That's right, yeah, it's actually doing something a little bit more than just not doing nothing. What would be the opposite of abstaining from unlawful sexual intercourse? What are you laughing at? It's not what you're thinking. The opposite is actually the unlawfulness of it is actually you're breaking trust. So it's because the opposite is actually not having sex, it means trusting each other and living up to that trust. Wash your mouth out with. So if you want. Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So So this is actually living up to one's trust and commitments. Abstain from lying is obviously telling the truth. Abstain from malicious tale-bearing is actually promoting harmony. Harsh language is not just not speaking at all, but it's not speaking well. Which is why that in Buddhism, there was actually a rule, I was just looking at it this afternoon, that during a range retreat, there was a group of monks who said, well, throughout the whole range retreat, we'll keep a vow of silence. So they wouldn't speak at all. And so when the lay people came to ask questions on Dhamma, the answer was silent. So the lay people complained to the Buddha. And the Buddha sort of actually made a rule, monks, you should not keep a vow of silence during the range retreat. Because actually keeping silence is quite easy. But speaking at the right time, not too much, not too little. Now that is the hard one. With kind speech. So this is actually why the opposite of...
So kind speech would be better than not speaking.
Indeed. At the right time, yeah. So that's why in Buddhism we don't have these vows of silence. A noble silence, as I mentioned in my retreats, is not speaking at all. It's speaking just the right amount at the right time. That's noble. And that's like, that's all the right speech. And covetousness, or sensual desire, is actually, the opposite of that is like contentment. The opposite of ill will is loving kindness. And obviously, they do actually have the opposite here. They don't say the absence of wrong view. They actually, from the start, they say, right understanding, a right view is karmically skillful. These are the 10, I call the good courses of action. Now what are the roots of wholesome or skillful karma? Absence of greed. In other words, it's called actually nekama, renunciation. Absence of hatred, which is kindness. When they say absence of hatred, that always means metta. And absence of delusion, other words known as wisdom. Yes. Okay. That's right, it's unskillful karma, it's certainly wrong understanding. And it's also, there's ill will there as well. And it says, you know, I don't want this to be, I want it to be different. So you're having ill will towards the process of dying. So, now that's one of the, that's actually from the first of the passages in the Samaditti Sutta. And it goes on afterwards, those you hear last year, or goes on with the dependent origination. It's also right view. But we also have here the understanding of the three characteristics. We had suffering, I mentioned there the 62 wrong views. This is also very typical of right view. And this, if anything, this is more fundamental. When one understands that the five khandhas, corporality, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, are anicca, transient, subject to suffering without a self, also in that case one possesses right understanding. And if anything, that is more fundamental because there is, remember one of my favorite suttas where it says that to see things as they truly are, the yathabhuta jnana dasana, what actually is seeing things as they truly are? And that is actually seeing these five khandhas as being without a self. Now we get unprofitable questions. Should anyone say that they do not wish to lead the holy life under the Blessed One, in other words, become a Buddhist or become a monastic, unless the Blessed One first tells him whether the world is eternal or temporal, finite or infinite, whether the life, actually finite or infinite, because I was a physicist, you know actually the answer to this question, is this universe finite or is it infinite? It is finite, but it is unbounded. So it is actually in between the two of these. It's got a finite area, finite volume, but it's got no edges to it. So that's why it's lovely to get your head around that. But it's not, extension in space. So there's no end to it. Space, yes. Space has got no limits. So you don't go and find a brick wall. You don't find the end of things. So it keeps going round and round and round, but it's got a finite size. And the answer is to that, if you're worrying about it, just like the simile of the ant on the football, the round ball. The surface of the football, it goes round and round and round and thinks, wow, this, how big is the surface area of the football? It's got a finite size. It's got no end to it. It goes round and round, can't find a boundary. Just like the universe. Curve in space-time. So you can't tell me, he's not going to live the whole life until you first tell him, whether the world is eternal, temporal, finite, infinite, whether the life principle is identical with the body or something different, whether the Buddha exists after death or whatever, such a one would die before the perfect one could tell him all this, explain it to him. And he would get the simile. It is as if a man were pierced by a poisoned arrow and his friends, companions or near relations should send for a surgeon, but that man should say, wait, I will not have this arrow pulled out until I know who the man is that has wounded me, whether he's a noble man, a priest, a tradesman, or a servant, or what his name is, and what family he belongs to, or whether he's tall, short, or medium height, or whether he has one spoon of sugar in his tea, or condensed milk. Truly, such a man would die before he could adequately learn all of this. So, that's why sometimes when the Christians ask you, well, just who created this universe? Is this world going to end? When is it going to end? Just say, come on, suffering is the most important part. Therefore, the person who seeks their own welfare should pull out this arrow, the arrow of lamentation, pain and sorrow. For whether the theory exists or whether it does not exist, that the world is eternal, temporal or final or infinite, yet certainly there exists birth. You've been born. You know that you came into this existence. I remember Ajahn Chah was asked once, he said, where did you come from? And I merely meant where he was born. He said, I come from the womb of my mum. So if anyone asks you, where did you come from, Nick? Don't say Switzerland. So I came from the womb of my mother. That's where your body comes from anyway. So yet there certainly exists birth, there exists decay, there exists death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, the extinction of which is attainable even in this present life, I make known unto you. The extinction of birth, extinction of decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That's the Buddha's teachings. Okay, now we have the five fetters, which is the first five of the ten fetters. I'll ask you if you know what the ten fetters are afterwards. Suppose, for instance, that there is an unlearned worldling, void of regard for holy people, ignorant of the teaching of holy people, untrained in the noble doctrine. And his heart, or her heart, their heart is possessed and overcome by self-delusion, by skepticism, by attachment to mere real ritual, by sensual lust, and by ill will. And how to free himself of those things, they in truth do not really know. So they say here, they're giving an example of self-illusion, Sakaya Ditti. Now this is one of those words again, they've got this kaya word in. So ditti, the view of with a body. And some people still, it's amazing, even to some monks in Thailand, they tell me, oh, sakaya ditti, that means you think that the body is a self. And please, just because it's got kaya in it doesn't mean it. Kaya means a group of things, and this means it means the five khandhas is a self. So Sakaya Ditti means you think that the five khandhas are a self, or contain a self, or are contained with a self, or identical to a self. And that comes up in a few minutes. So, but they have here Sakaya Ditti, the self view, that there's a self in there somewhere. Either it reveals itself as eternalism. In other words, the belief that one's ego, self, or soul, or mind, or consciousness, whatever you call it, exists independently of the material body and continues even after the dissolution of the body. We all know the body dies. But you see, something left there, some trace, some mind, some ground of all being, which will exist afterwards, forever, that is. That's eternalism. And annihilation is that the materialistic belief that the present life constitutes the ego, and at the death, everything is gone. And that's the annihilationist view, in terms of Buddhism. And so, one says the soul exists, one says the soul does not exist. So what's the alternative? Yeah, the middle way. That there is a self is wrong, there is nothing is wrong. Instead you have this process. This process, this causal sequence, which you can actually see just how these sensory experiences to all the six senses, they arise because of causes, and they sort of create the next sensory experience, and this whole momentum, usually driven by craving, by wanting, or by its opposite, ill will, that drives this whole process. And once you actually see how this process is driven, that is what people take to be a self, and that is what keeps going after death. That keeps the processes going. So it's not eternalism, because it's a process, it can end. If it was an essential thing which was permanent, had a permanent core to it, of course it can't end. And you can't say it's nothing there. That would be annihilationism. So it's this in between, this process, rather than the thing, rather than nothing, which is what the Buddha called the middle way. But anyway, five fetters, that's the self-delusion. What about skepticism and attachment to mere rules and ritual? What do those mean? What does skepticism mean? What is it? I don't know. Is that skepticism then? It's a doubt. Isn't doubt a very good thing to have? Which says here it's a fetter.
Unwise.
Well, what's the difference between wise doubt and unwise doubt?
Well, wise doubt is where you say you don't know because you know you don't know. You know because you know. And unwise one would be where you...
Is that you, Wrigley?
No, I'm trying to answer your question. Good straight answer.
It's a lack of faith. Feels like a lack of faith in teachings.
It's just what wrong view is. When there is right view, you just know for yourself.
As long as it doesn't destroy investigation of truth, I think there might be some doubt.
Yes, Greg?
It's like if someone has a lottery ticket and they tell you that they're going to win, then it's wise to doubt that because they're probably not. But if they bought all the lottery ticket numbers except for one, and they tell you that they're probably going to win, then it's not wise to doubt that because they are probably going to win.
Now remember, this is the doubt. If you're honest, you always will have doubt, unless you've experienced something. So, you do your doubt about rebirth. Until you've experienced something, of course you will have that doubt. So the only way to have this skepticism doubt overcome is through an experience. This is actually the simile between the tadpole and the keep on saying the frog. So the frog has actually gone out of the lake. So it knows, yes, there is something beyond water. So, when it says skepticism here, it's not that skepticism is wrong, it's skepticism, you have to have skepticism. You have to have doubt. That's one of the nicest things about Buddhism. You're not putting down doubt. Ask questions. Don't believe. When Sariputta was asked a question I heard a teaching by the Buddha, and the Buddha asked afterwards, do you believe that? Sariputta said no. He said, why? Because I haven't experienced that yet. Well done, Sariputta. He was praised for that. So it's okay to have doubt, to have skepticism. But it still becomes a fetter in the sense that it still means that you haven't actually seen for yourself. So when you actually see for yourself, that is when that skepticism disappears. So that's when actually you don't just have faith in the Buddha's teachings, you actually see it. Yes? Correct.
So does that also mean that until you're an arahant, you still have some kind of doubt along the way?
Now, until you're extreme with that. So that's when you see something, like it's gone out of view, but oh, you know it's there.
Well, when you're extreme with it, you're not doubting anymore.
You don't, because you see.
Anything about teaching.
Exactly. That's why they say you have unshakable confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
On a lower level.
So you have an unshakable, the frog. Has unshakable confidence that dry land exists.
On a lower level, if we're practicing and we have doubt about the Buddha's teaching, it can be a great fetter.
It can be a great fetter, yeah, but it doesn't mean that
means we shouldn't question.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't mean doubt in that sense, because
mm-hmm.
that doubt is a very, very negative fetter. Mm-hmm. It means that you still have the openness of mind. Because that's what really surprised me, just talking about something like reincarnation. That, you know, I sort of took that for granted. But when I came over to Australia, I realized that people didn't have an open mind. They actually had a very strong belief that reincarnation didn't exist. It wasn't an open mind at all. They'd already decided, you know, without evidence, that it didn't exist. So it was a strong belief. So they resisted it.
So that marks the Buddha believed sexual relations were okay.
Yeah.
The Buddha.
This way. Yeah.
So even though he had his own experience,
yes, yeah.
He did trust the teachings.
Yes, right, yeah.
And the teaching over and over, practiced in one place.
That's right, yeah. But still, when you have those teachings, you can take them for granted and still take them as on faith, but you still have a bit of doubt there because you don't know, but it sounds good. But that doubt is totally overcome. And it's only when it's totally overcome, that's why when it's totally overcome, you actually know, yes, it is bad, or it is going to be sort of an obstacle. Only then can you resist it. Because before then,
practice itself
sees, you know, what the goal is. Once you know what the goal is, you see the nirvana, you understand what it is, you understand there's no self in here. That's when you get, as I said before, that's when you become seka, a learner. Only then do you get your L plates. That's really sort of, wow, I have to do all that before I get my L plate. What am I doing now? Just drag around like a fool. Your L plate. Okay, that's skepticism. What about attachment to mere rule and ritual? Are you guys attached to your rules and rituals by keeping those 8 precepts? Come on, hang loose. Have something to eat tonight. Let's have a party. Let's go and send sort of who's on driving duty this week. Scott? Do the bottle shop still open? Let's go and get some liquor. That's being recorded. Scott said that. Is that what it means by not being attached to rules and rituals? Of course it doesn't. As you all know, this idea of attachment, you know, it's the word is paramasa. It's not this, no, quite the same. This is the idea that just by keeping these rules and keeping these rituals is going to make you enlightened just by itself. And they give examples, again, in the Digha Nikaya, of the person who did the dog ritual and the cow ritual. And this was when a person, that the cow ritual, he went around on all fours, slept with the cows and ate grass all day. But the dog practice, the dog ascetic, he went again, also on all fours, went woof woof and ate dog food and hung out with the dogs. And you know, this was in India, they still do weird stuff like this in India, and they thought, you know, this is such a hard thing to do, it's really ascetic actually to live and sleep like a dog. You know, really sort of do it full on, you need a lot of training to do that. And to get used to dog food or just to eat grass, and they thought that this is going to be the path to enlightenment. And that was their practice. And they went to ask the Buddha, and he said, what would happen? And he said, well, the dog ascetic, if you keep practicing like that, in your next life you'd be reborn as a dog. And the cow, you'd be reborn as a cow. It's obvious. That's what you attain, what you aspire towards.
Yeah, so it doesn't mean that you feel that if you're not doing this practice, you don't go to church every Sunday, and you know that, then something bad's going to happen.
Close to that, if you just go to church, that's all you need to do, and then you can sort of go to heaven forever after. In other words, it's seeing that there's much more than just to keeping the rules or doing the rituals. So there's something deeper than that. It doesn't mean you abandon all rules and rituals. You actually see their place in the spiritual practice and the path.
The kind of practice you do is the fire mission.
Yeah.
They used to light a fire, parents. Yeah. That's when the child was 16.
Yeah.
And if he's going to read the holy light,
yeah,
become whatever, Brahma, yeah, or whatever, then he has to take the flame and keep it burning, feed it,
yeah,
for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And if he does that, he will
reach some place. Yeah. It's a ritual, yeah. Those sorts of beliefs. Or a common belief, the belief that if you keep on chanting Ami Tofo, you get reborn in the Pure Land. Now that is for right here to attachment to mere rules and rituals. So what that really means is that just not really understanding the place of these rituals, you know, such as entering the rains, such as bowing, such as what other rituals, such as the chanting we do, and the precepts which we keep, understanding their meaning, and understanding that they're important, but they're not the be-all and end-all of monastic life. And the other two, when those three are overcome, you're a stream winner. When sensual lust, and that's the five senses, karma, raga, and ill will, and those two are lessened, once returner, totally overcome, is an anagam. So now we have a very interesting passage, because sometimes people look at this and think, well, something wrong here. These are unwise considerations. At yonisa, manasikara. Not knowing what is worthy of consideration and what is unworthy of consideration, they consider the unworthy and not the worthy. So unwisely, they consider this. Now, it's not just considering about, you know, your past sexual relationships or what you're going to do after the rains or about your family, about the economy. Of course, those are unwise, but this is more philosophical. Unwise considerations. Have I been in the past? Or have I not been in the past? What have I been in the past? How have I been in the past? From what state into what state did I change in the past? Shall I be in the future or shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? From what state into what state shall I change in the future? I just pause there for a while. But don't I ask you to sometimes remember your past lives and find out, were you in the past? What were you in the past? Yeah, I do, don't I? So am I taking some unwise considerations? Experience. The point is here, it doesn't come out in the English, but the main reason why this is an unwise, because in each one of these questions, it's all about I and me. It's, you know, have I been in the past? It presupposes that you are some sort of soul. This is why it's called an unwise. It's not actually what is this I? It's, you know, where does I come from? Who was I in a past life? So it's identifying a past life as being, you know, you, your essence, this is me, rather than this is just this causal process. So in each one of these, have I been in the past? Have I not been? What have I? How have I been in the past? From what state to what state did I change? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? From what state to what state shall I change into the future? This all presupposes the sense of a self. And the same with the next one. And the peasant also fills him with doubt. Am I or am I not? What am I? How am I? This being, whence does it come? Whither should it go? And this is all presupposing a sense of the self there. In the sense I am not, what that truly means and what should be translated that, you know, am I destined for cessation? So in each one, it's all about me. And so I often say that, so there was the, when I was young, investigating all sorts of different spiritual practices, there was that teacher Ramana Maharshi, and his question was always, who am I? And I always thought that that was a bit sort of suspicious, because who am I? You know, was presupposing you are something, it's just trying to find out who you are. And what am I is closer to a good question, but the best question is not who am I or what am I, because that supposes you are something, just trying to find out what it is. I prefer to say, you know, what do I take myself to be?
Now.
Now, yeah. What do I assume myself? You know, who do I take myself to be? Who is this Peter, which I, you know, grew up with and know right now? So I found that a much better sort of way of understanding sort of anatta. Because I understood, what do I take myself to be? I take myself to be the abbot. That's not true. Now you can sort of dissemble that pretty quickly. I am this body. No, I'm not this body. It's been a totally different body before. So if I take myself to be the body, that's not me. Do I take myself to be all my attainments? And that's not me. What do I take myself to be? When I keep asking that question, sooner or later, just there's nothing left. My will, do I take myself to be my will? I've seen through that before. I'm not the will. Do I take myself to be the knower? Seen through that too. So I've got nothing else I can actually put this label I onto. Now that is a wise consideration, because that actually destroys the sense of self. Yeah, go on.
Is it also something to do with just that it's about consideration, whereas actually contemplation is the way to answer these questions too?
Not really, because the very question is wrongly formed. It's an assumption in the very beginning of the question. And that assumption is that there is a self. It's just finding out what it is, where it came from. The conceiving, yes. A question which you've already made an assumption through the Vipalasas, and you know, you're never going to get a good answer unless you do the correct question. The very question is wrong. May the five candors be happy with you.
So for someone who has not come progress so far, it's very confusing.
It can be,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So all you can say to yourself, you say, may the five candors be happy and well.
May the stream of consciousness.
That's right, may the stream of consciousness be happy and well. May some of it be happy or well.
It's okay to say may all things be happy, even though they're not things. It's okay to say may I, because we're using it in a conventional sense.
Correct, yes.
And it's to help our practice.
Yeah, that's good enough. There's a conventional sense. In other words, you realize when you say it as a Buddhist, what the I means is just, you know, this group of five khandhas. What Polian means is just the name you put to those five khandhas.
It's inconvenient.
Yes, right, yeah. So may the five khandhas consisting of body, feeling, perception, our mental formations and consciousness will be happy and well. It's much quicker to say I. Yes, five candles?
Vipalasa or something?
Vipalasa, yeah, that's the perversion of the conceptual process, just the way that your perception and your thoughts are bent. They're not accurate. You perceive what you want to perceive, and you're in denial to what you hate to see. It's always the case. So, now it gets more clear. The six views about the self. And with such unwise consideration, you adopt one or other of the six views. Having considered this way, this is where it leads. And it becomes your conviction and your belief. I have a self. Or I have no self. Isn't that anatta? What's the difference between anatta doctrine and where it says I have no self?
That
correct, yeah. So you still think you're there, somewhere. So I have a self, I have no self. Or with, now we've got these ones. With a self, I perceive the self. With that which is no self, I perceive the self. Or with the self, I perceive that which is no self. And if you're a mathematician, you know this one of the four combinations is missed out. No, the one which is missed out is, with that which is no self, I see that which is no self. I perceive the no self. So, with the self, I perceive the self. With that which is no self, I perceive the self. With the self, I perceive that which is no self. Last one, with that which is no self, I perceive that which is no self. And that is left out there because that's what one's supposed to do. That's the right one. That's the view which you're supposed to have. With that which is no self, you perceive that which is no self. Or you adopt the following view, which is what most people do, because it's much easier, all this no self and no self. This is what most people do, put it back down to earth. This is myself, which can think and feel the doer and the knower. Okay, so this is one place where I hang this doer and knowing business. This is myself which can think and feel, which can do and which can know. And which now here, now there, experiences the fruit in good and evil deeds. This myself is permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change, and will thus eternally remain the same. So I love that one, because that's where it says the main thing is the doer and the knower. That's where you think you are. Now if, please pay attention to this one, this is powerful. If there really existed a self, you know, a real self, there would also exist some which belonged to the self. In other words, wherever there's a belonging, there is also a self. Where there's a self, there's some which you want. This is where craving comes from. Once it's a sense of self, you will own something, you will crave something, you will grasp and attach to something. That's the nature of a self. To own, to grasp. Which is why that the things which you assume to belong to you, when they start to disappear in meditation, that's where fear comes from. When there's a self, there's things which belong to you. Your body, your will, your happiness, your mind. Does your mind belong to you? Does your consciousness belong to you? Does your will belong to you? If you can say with full honesty, no, with honesty, then okay, you're streaming it. But a lot of times, well, yeah, we could sort of say that, but it's not really honest. Because sometimes we do own our will. We do own our consciousness. See, even sometimes we own our body. When it starts to disappear, we get scared or we get sick. Or we get a lump somewhere. Cancer. It's cancer. I'm dying. You're not dying. The body's dying, that's all. So if there really existed a self, it also exists some which belong to the self. So from that saying, if you want to find out what a self is, what is this soul? What does it own? What do you own? What do you really understand as belonging to you? And from that contemplation, you can find out what the self is in practice for you, by what you possess. When you have no possessions at all, then there's no self left. As, however, in truth and reality, there is neither a self nor anything belonging to the self can be found. Isn't that a great relief? There's nothing belonging to me anymore. So I can do whatever I like, say whatever I like. I'm not a fool anymore. Because all my actions, do they really belong to me? If you really think like that, you don't do anything bad. The only reason you do anything bad is because of pride and because of attachment. These are the roots of unwholesome actions. So it's a great relief to think, I own nothing. So when you own nothing, you've got nothing to lose at all. All fear disappears. I think Bob Dylan said that, didn't he? When you own nothing, you've got nothing to lose. You ain't got no secrets anymore. Just like a Rolling Stone, wasn't it? Does anyone know Bob Dylan? I think it's something like that anyway. Anyway, here we go. Howsoever, truth and reality and either self and anything belonging to a self can be found, is it not therefore really an utter false doctrine to say, this is the world, this am I, after death I should be permanent, persisting and eternal? The Buddha said that's a false doctrine. So these are called the thicket of mere views, ditti, a thicket of views, a puppet show of views, a toil of views, a snare of views. And ensnared in the fetter of views, the ignorant worldling would not be free from rebirth, from decay, from death, from sorrow, pain, grief, and despair. Would not be freed, I say, from suffering. And this is quite some very emotive similes when it says a thicket of views. In other words, you get, like, have you ever gone through like a bramble patch? Spiky bushes. Brambles, spiky bushes. You know, it's just hard to get through it and you get caught up in it. Or if you like to, you know, if you go through like barbed wire fences, so you get sort of your robes caught and the things caught up and it's sort of sticky. That's like the thicket of views. A puppet show of views. If you've seen the puppet shows, in other words, sometimes they make it look like it's real. A toil of views, I mean, it's just so hard. A snare of views, you get caught up in it, just like the animal gets caught in the snare. Then you'll never be freed. Now that's the unwise considerations. The wise considerations, the learned, noble disciple, however, as regard for holy men, who knows the teachings of the holy people, well trained in the noble doctrine, they understand what is worthy of consideration, what is unworthy. So instead of saying about this self business, so that what they consider is worthy, not the unworthy, what they consider is worthy is what suffering is, you wisely consider. What the origin of suffering is, you wisely consider. What the extinction of suffering is. What the path is that leads to extinction of suffering. That's called wise consideration. So find out just why we suffer, why you have pain, why you have irritation, where that all comes from, and how to overcome that, how to transcend that. So that's a wise consideration. So instead of being philosophical, we're practical. And thus, by thus considering, three fetters vanish, namely self-illusion, scepticism, and this attachment to mere rules and rituals. And those disciples in whom these three fetters have vanished, they have all entered the stream of Sotapanna. More than any earthly power, more than all the joys of heaven, more than rule over all the world, is the entrance to the stream. Better than winning the lottery. Better than scoring the winning goal in the World Cup final. Better than falling in love with the most beautiful person in the whole world. Better than, what else do people aspire towards?
Mushy peas.
Mushy peas. Yeah, better than mushy peas and condensed milk in the morning. His entrance to the stream. Porridge. Okay. Is that all you have? Porridge. Goodness. Maybe it's whatever you like, anyway. Entrance to the stream. So that's... Because when you enter the stream, the reason why they have that here is because one who's entered the stream, they call it ditti sampanno. They are endowed, completed, right view. So a stream winner has actually fulfilled the first act of the Eightfold Path. They sometimes call it attained to view. What it means, like, they've got right view. They've understood Four Noble Truths. They've understood Anatta. There's nobody in here. They've understood sort of impermanence. What's the nature to arise is totally the nature to cease. What's in the nature to arise? Your five khandhas. So they're the nature to cease. Totally. Just like the lamp.
Well, it says...
What God?
Sorry.
Yeah?
It says that it's better than the... But then again, you know, the stream enter still has central lust.
Oh, yeah, they do, yeah. But even that amount... The reason is, they say, is because, you know, when you enter the stream, you know that you're being reborn so many times. you know you've only got 7 lifetimes left. That's why the Buddha actually said this to Ananda. He said, look, be careful, don't spread this teaching around too much, because sometimes people might misunderstand this. He said, he picked up a small amount of dirt on his finger. What's more, the dirt on the tip of my finger or this grey earth? And Ananda said, obviously the grey earth is big. He said, just the same for a stream winner. The amount of suffering they've got left, it's just compared to the amount of suffering they've been through. It's just like this small amount of earth on my fingertip compared to the whole earth. So they say that once you're a stream winner, you realize you're out. You're getting out soon. It's like a person who's been in prison for not just 20, 30, 40 years, but 400 years, 10,000 years, a billion years. And then they got their parole. So in 7 lifetimes' time, you're going to get out of jail. Of course, they'll be just so delighted. You know, suffering is ending. Like a person who's had this terrible sickness, and the doctor comes along and says, we found the cure. You know, we're just going to do that now in a few days, you'll be free of hospital. So that's at the end of suffering. So that's why it's the most, more than earthly power and joys of heaven, rule over all the world, is the fact to know that what the problem was, the problem has been solved, it's only a matter of a short time and you're out of here. The end of suffering is now. Well, see, for the 7 lifetimes, I think it's, instead of saying 7, you know that, look, you're more, the sense of self, the stream of consciousness, is actually mortally wounded. It can't last very long. So 7 is just, you know, it's going. It can't be that much further. So I wouldn't actually even put it down. I'm going to be quite radical and say even 7, 8, 6, roughly about that time. It's not going to be long. No short time, yeah, and you really know it's no short time. Yeah.
I was wondering about the term sotapanna. Does it have something to do with sota, like the faculty of hearing?
Or? No, it means stream. So you've entered the stream, in other words, once in that stream, you can't get out again.
Okay.
And it leads to nirvana. And basically, the whole process, again using the term of a process, the process is just in this terminal mode. It started, you're in that stream, you're in that sort of causal process. There's no way back anymore. And you know it's going to end soon. Because the very cause of rebirth, the delusion of a self, the main cause has been seen through. And once that is gone, you realize there's no self in there. All this belongings of a self, they just fall away, little by little. There's no one in there to hold it onto anymore. It's just like the knot has been untied. The bolt which kept it all together has been taken out so that the whole thing sort of starts falling apart. Yeah? Pardon?
To be reborn, is it always a condition to be reborn into a human form so that they can continue?
For stream winner, no, sometimes in heaven realms. Yeah, sure. So it's 7 more lifetimes. We'll come on to that next time, because I was going to finish off, because it's gone long enough now.
They use stream, and the other one's round.
Yeah.
So the round came, the
stream goes. Leaves, yeah. Because again, when you talk about processes, you know, the stream is actually like, even like video streaming. You know, it gives an idea of like a process, which is actually a very good word. So some of the words which are used here was very powerful. So the pana again means attain to the stream. Like sometimes they call it dittipana, attain to view, or attain to the stream, attain to that view which leads out of samsara.
What was the word?
Dittipana.
No, detain.
Attain.
Attain.
Attain. No. Yeah, attained to ditti, to view. But sometimes that in Pali, whenever they say ditti, like Sakaya ditti, oh no, Sakaya ditti is okay, ditti, sometimes by itself it means like a wrong view. And that's very common in Thai language. When they say someone's got ditti, it means they've got like wrong view. So when they use ditti without the prefix samaditti, right view, it's always assumed it's a wrong view. And because there's 62 wrong views and there's only one right view, it's pretty more likely if you've got ditty it's one of the wrong ones. But there's such a thing as right view. And I mentioned this, right view doesn't mean no view at all. Because sometimes people like the eel wrigglers, they say, well, you know, have you got a view? He said, no, I'm not attached to any view. He said, well, that's a view. Yes, but I'm not attached to it. And it's, you know, becomes sort of the eel wrigglers. So you've got to be very careful. And it's very nice, that term, eel wrigglers, because, you know, the eels are so slippy, you can't get hold of them. And that's, you know, that's from the time of the Buddha. Okay. So, that is enough for today. And next time we'll start doing the 10 fetters and we'll talk about different stages of enlightenment. We go on, I'll just give you a preview. Mundane and super mundane understanding. Be careful of that one because that people like Anarya, Bhikkhu, Bodhi, Ajahn Bambari found out that this sutta, which it comes from mundane and super mundane understanding, it's not in all the other traditions and it looks like it's been added on. And it's much of it, you can actually see what's been added on to, transposed from the Abhidharma into the sutta, so that's an interesting one. And do dependent origination afterwards, and that will finish the right understanding. So that'd be very easy to maybe finish that next week. Enough for today.